Today is Wednesday, August 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump has canceled a scheduled meeting with the Prime Minister of Denmark.
It is with regret and surprise that I received the news that President Trump has canceled his state visit to Denmark.
Also ahead, an American MQ-9 drone was shot down over Yemen late Tuesday. And we continue taking a look back at the slave trade in the U.S. as VOA travels to Angola. All of these stories and more are all coming up next. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said Wednesday that she regretted and was surprised that U.S. President Donald Trump abruptly canceled his scheduled visit to Denmark when she rebuffed his overture to buy Greenland, the Arctic country that is part of the Danish kingdom.
It is with regret and surprise that I received the news that President Trump has canceled his state visit to Denmark on the 2nd and 3rd September. I had been looking forward to the visit. Our preparations were well underway. It was an opportunity, I think, to celebrate Denmark's close relationship to U.S.
Mr. Trump called off the September 2nd and 3rd visit late on Tuesday while saying that, quote, Denmark is a very special country with incredible people, end quote. Now, to get the latest of the diplomatic row over Greenland and more, I'm joined on the phone by VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to talk to you, Steve.
So the president just concluded an event on the South Lawn. What exactly did he say about the diplomatic row between the Washington White House and the prime minister in Denmark?
Yes, the president spent about 35 minutes on the South Lawn before boarding Marine One under a hot, sunny sky of around 32 degrees Celsius. But he was obviously hot under the collar about Denmark and explained that he had canceled his visit to Copenhagen because he felt that he was insulted by the Prime Minister of Denmark. The president said that she was basically nasty in calling it absurd, his proposal that Denmark sell Greenland to the United States.
Did the White House get any information ahead of time that indicated that at least Denmark would be open to such a possibility or that Greenland would be receptive of that?
No, this is something that the president had put out there. It's unclear whether there had been any discussions about it. It appears that there was not. And, of course, the president on Tuesday evening had taken to Twitter to announce that he was canceling the trip. Now, the president, just a little while ago in talking about this, said, you know, this was really nothing new, that whole idea of Greenland being sold to the United States went back to the administration of Harry Truman just after World War II.
Is there any other information coming out from the White House about what will take place in the future if he is going to go to Denmark at any time in the near vicinity?
Well, it doesn't look like he's going in the near future. The president says he loves Denmark, likes the people very much there, and it's remarkable about the way this was canceled, because it wasn't the prime minister who invited the president. The formal invitation came from the queen of Denmark. So this is a snub that, you know, goes into a different area of protocol between these two allies. It should be noted that, you know, some people might think, you know, okay, what's the big deal about Denmark? But the United States for decades has had a very important military base at Thule in Greenland, and that also demonstrates just how strategic Greenland is.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
My pleasure, Steve.
A U.S. official confirms to VOA that an American MQ-9 drone was shot down over Yemen late Tuesday. The official told VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, quote, it's the Houthis, but it's enabled by Iran, end quote. The MQ-9 drone was shot down in Yemen's Damar governorate, southeast of the Houthi-controlled capital Sana'a, according to two U.S. officials speaking to the Reuters news agency. It's the second such incident in recent months. And this is not the first time a U.S. drone has been shot down in Yemen. In June, the U.S. military said that Houthi rebels had shot down a U.S. government-operated drone with the assistance of Iran. The U.S. Central Command is investigating the reports of the attack by the Iranian-backed Houthis forces on the U.S. unmanned aircraft system operating in what it says was authorized airspace over Yemen. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has named Iran as the biggest threat to the security and stability of the Middle East. In a speech to the UN Security Council on Tuesday addressing complex challenges facing the Middle East, Pompeo called for fresh thinking to solve old problems. Some participants blamed regional and international powers, including the United States, for adding to the tensions in the region with their selfish unilateral motives. VOA's Lettice Hoek has that story.
Iran's nuclear threat, devastating wars in Syria and Yemen, longtime conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and economic inequality in the Middle East dominated discussions Tuesday at the UN Security Council. Pompeo said Iran's nuclear program and its actions in the Strait of Hormuz are a threat to the world, and that its interference in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen is having devastating humanitarian consequences in the region.
Clearly, from Aleppo to Aden, from Tripoli to Tehran, greater cooperation in the Middle East is needed more than ever. We need fresh thinking to solve old problems.
Pompeo said the United States and Poland have formed seven working groups to address security and other issues in a peace initiative called the Warsaw Process. Russia has rejected the process as a unilateral and undiplomatic move.
We cannot be satisfied with a situation where calls for Iran to sit down at a negotiating table are punctuated with direct insults, direct provocations, and demeaning sanctions.
The Russian representative said U.S. sanctions against Iran violate international laws and have brought the country's economy to a standstill. He said the U.S. aggressive stance, including insults and ultimatums, contribute to the turmoil in the whole region. A German representative said a rise of unilateral moves has exacerbated tensions in the Middle East. He called for a coordination of international efforts and also urged regional leaders to respect human rights of their own people.
It is for the nations of the regions themselves to create political environments which allow their people to lead a life without fear of repression and torture, hunger and violence, and which instead provides them with safety, dignity and liberty.
International envoys called on all parties to respect international agreements and UN resolutions, notably those calling for a two-state solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They emphasized an urgent need for economic development in some of the most turbulent areas and identified a need for improved education and job opportunities for women and growing young populations. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Among other top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro say that members of their administrations have engaged in dialogue. More than 80 migrants are on dry land after nearly 20 days at sea, and Italy has seized their Spanish charity rescue ship. Sino-Philippine ties are showing signs of cooling, according to a recent survey on how much Filipinos trust their Asian neighbor. The Trump administration is moving to end a long-standing federal agreement that limits how long immigration children can be kept in detention. A court fight will most certainly follow. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our mobile app. This is VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australia's Cardinal George Pell, a former advisor to Pope Francis, has lost his appeal against his convictions for sexually abusing two choir boys in the late 1990s when he was Archbishop of Melbourne. Phil Mercer reports his appeal judges at the Victorian Court of Appeal ruled against him in a 2-1 decision.
Once part of the Pope's inner circle, George Pell arrived to hear his fate in the back of a prison van and wearing a clerical collar. He was found guilty last December of a brazen and forcible sexual attack on two choir boys in Melbourne in the late 1990s. In March, he was jailed for 6 years. His lawyers said the case against him was flawed because the jury relied on the uncorroborated evidence of the surviving boy. But the Victorian Court of Appeal disagreed. Chief Justice Anne Ferguson said the victim was reliable.
Justice Maxwell and I accepted the prosecution's submission that the complainant was a very compelling witness, was clearly not a liar, was not a fantasist, and was a witness of truth.
Outside the court, Chrissy Foster, who campaigns for victims of clerical abuse, said she welcomed the ruling.
Just a wonderful, wonderful day for survivors, for victims. I think it sends a message that justice will be served no matter how high you are or how old you are or, you know, what your job is. This is a crime. It's against children, that innocence just taken and destroyed.
George Pell is the most senior Catholic figure worldwide to be guilty of child sexual abuse. But this case might not be over. His legal team is considering challenging his convictions in Australia's High Court. The 78-year-old Pell is now back in prison in disgrace for crimes he committed more than 20 years ago when he was Archbishop of Melbourne. He'll have to serve more than 3 years behind bars before he's eligible for parole. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Melbourne.
Protesters in Hong Kong brought their message to commuters Wednesday on the one-month anniversary of a subway station attack by suspected gang members. Michael Sullivan reports that protesters want an independent investigation into the violent incident.
An unprovoked attack that left at least 45 injured, captured in a Facebook live stream. White-shirted men, thought to be triad gang members sympathetic to Beijing, attacked activists, travelers, and journalists. Protesters urged commuters, don't forget.
So a month ago in Yunnan Station, a group of triads of over 100 rushed into the station, attacking passengers and staff. And I think this shouldn't happen in a society like Hong Kong.
Hong Kong's busy subway system has returned to normal, but 1 month after the attack, police have filed no charges.
That is 1 month later and no one was prosecuted. They just arrested some of people, but not prosecuted yet. So we are remind the Hong Kong people, don't let them forget this thing.
Why, protesters ask, were police so slow to respond to the mass attack? More station protests are planned for Friday. 1 month later, a demand for answers. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Hong Kong.
China has confirmed it has detained an employee of Hong Kong's British consulate. Foreign Ministry spokesman Gong Shuang said the employee has been placed in administrative detention for 15 days as punishment for violating a law on public order. He didn't provide further details, but said the man was a Hong Kong resident and not a British citizen. Hong Kong's local news website, HK01, said the employee, identified as Simon Cheng, failed to return to the former British colony from the neighboring city of Shenzhen on August 9th, where he had gone to attend a business meeting. Britain's Foreign Office said it was extremely concerned by reports that he had been detained. Military and civilian members of Sudan's new ruling body, the Sovereign Council, were sworn in today at the presidential palace in Khartoum. The 11-member council replaces the now-defunct Transitional Military Council, the head of which, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, was sworn in as head of the Sovereign Council earlier on Wednesday. Prime Minister nominee Abdallah Hamdok is expected to be sworn in at the end of the day. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says it may be possible to remove a key hurdle standing in the way of an orderly British departure from the European Union before October 31st. Merkel told reporters in Berlin on Wednesday that a solution for the Irish border issue may be found in the next 30 days if all sides work hard. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that he will not accept a so-called Irish backstop clause in the divorce agreement his predecessor negotiated. The latest round of U.S.-South Korean military exercises have ended, and the top U.S. envoy for North Korea is currently in Seoul. VOA's Bill Gallo reports that everything seems to be in place for the resumption of long-delayed working-level nuclear talks with North Korea, everything that is, except for North Korea.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un may have promised to resume talks when the U.S.-South Korean military drills ended. They did end Tuesday. A day later, Steve Biegun, the top U.S. envoy for North Korea, confirmed during a visit to Seoul he hadn't heard from the North.
Regarding the restart of those negotiations, we are prepared to engage as soon as we hear from our counterparts in North Korea.
Instead, North Korean state media blasted the U.S. for holding the drills at all and hinted the North could soon return to larger provocations. The latest U.S.-South Korean exercises were computer-based, meaning there were no bombs dropped on dummy targets or overt displays of military strength. But North Korea has continued to complain about the scaled-back drills, saying it sees them as preparation to invade. William Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of Chicago found evidence that supports a link between exposure to environmental pollution and neuropsychiatric disorders such as bipolar disorder and depression. The researchers analyzed information from a U.S. health insurance database which contained neuropsychiatric disease claims for 151 million people. They then compared patient location information from the health insurance database to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency measurements taken in various U.S. localities of 87 potential air pollutants. According to the study, the U.S. counties with the worst air quality also had a 27% increase in bipolar disorder and a 6% increase in major depression compared to areas with the best air quality. The researchers were able to validate their U.S. findings by applying their methodology to data called from similar data sets in Denmark. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. This year marks the 400th anniversary since the first enslaved African set foot in what now is the United States. The arrival in the British colony of Virginia in August of 1619 of a ship carrying Africans from Angola marked the start of more than 200 years of slavery in America. VOA's Myra de la Sotle traveled to Angola to learn more about one of the origins of the transatlantic slave trade and its lingering impact on the region. Earlier, I sat down with Myra to talk about her experiences in reporting on the trip. I began our conversation by asking her what was it like to go back to Angola to cover this important story. Myra, can you really take us through what it was like for you personally to go to Angola and carry out this reporting trip?
Yeah, thank you, Steve. It was an amazing experience. I got to learn more than I thought that I knew. You know, when you don't know that you don't know,
mm-hmm.
That was the experience. I always thought that I knew everything about slavery. I had history classes throughout my life, so I really thought that I got it. And then when I started talking with Angolan historians, there was so much more, another perspective on this that books don't tell us.
So what really surprised you when you started delving into this topic?
What really surprised me, I think, two or three things. One is one thing that one of the historians told us when I asked her, how did Africans allow an invasion like this? And she said, no, you got this all wrong. This wasn't an invasion. When Portuguese arrived in Angola, they came in peace. They came as friends. We exchanged gifts. And it was a 100-year relationship with nothing but good things.
Then what happened to turn things around?
And then they realized that there was a system of slavery. There was, if one tribe lost a war with another tribe, then the ones that lost would have to be held by the winners. And after that, they thought, well, we just need to back up the stronger ones here, and then we can start doing the transatlantic trade.
So if I understand you correctly, then the Portuguese were backing the winning tribes, and the practice was that if you lost, you were then essentially enslaved into the winning tribes, and then Portuguese would then take those people in and traffic them.
Then Portuguese realized, well, we backed you up. We need this man too. These are our prizes too, right? This is an award for us too. And then we do whatever we think is proper to do with this prize.
So in addition to these things that you didn't know about the slave trade when you arrived in Angola, what are other things that people, you know, should know about what took place 400 years ago?
I think that people need to understand how history was written. There was another thing also that was light for me. It was enlightful. It was that we read a lot. We are very knowledgeable about things and slavery specifically. But the other perspective, the African perspective, is not written anywhere. It's not being taught in any school. And we need that. We always say there are always two sides of the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So history is the same thing. And I think that we are lacking that. We are lacking the other side. We are lacking how the things were processed in Africa to get to here. And that's what I learned.
Mauro de la Salette reports for VOA's Portuguese service, and you can see all of her reports, her reporter's notebook, and her fantastic television packages on the voanews.com website. Mauro, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, tomorrow, Thursday, August 22nd, VOA and Norfolk State University will hold an international town hall to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first Africans landing in North America. That event will be televised live from 16:30 to 17:30 UTC. And if you'd like to watch the event live, you can do so. You'll find the televised stream at our website, voanews.com, or at youtube.com/VOA video. And we'll take a quick look back in time before I go today. It was on this day in 1609 that Galileo Galilei demonstrated his new telescope to a group of officials atop the Campanile in Venice. And in 1912, the Boy Scouts of America named its first Eagle Scout, Arthur Rose Eldred, of Troop 1 in Rockville Center, New York. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Rob McLean, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.